Turning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, the myth of a polarized America. In Culture Wars, Morris Fiorina argues that Americans are far less polarized than the public is led to believe by the media and political pundits. Morris Fiorina is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute and a professor of political science at Stanford University.
Stanford Professor Morris Fiorina is the author of this book. Several editions of this book have come out. Culture War, The Myth of a Polarized America. Professor Fiorina, are we divided into red and blue camps in this country?
It depends on who you mean by we. If you mean by the people who are very active in politics, who run for office, who work in the campaigns and give money, yes, they are. If you mean by we, the ordinary average American citizen who basically just turns out to vote, the answer is no, we are not.
How do you find that?
We find that through very intensive looks at American surveys, the American National Election Studies, the General Social Survey, some of the good commercial surveys like Gallup, etc. And what they show basically is the American electorate today doesn't look any different in terms of its partisanship or its ideology or its issue positions than the American electorate in the 1970s. So the electoral changes we're seeing are changes being driven by the people at the elite level, the people who are most active in politics. They are clearly very different. They are much more polarized, much more ideological. Their priorities are different, but it's not the ordinary. The ordinary voter can only vote between the alternatives that he or she is provided. And if they're given only extremists to vote for or against, that's all they can vote for is an extremist.
Now, Professor Fiorina, you started writing this series or this book in 2006 or so.
Actually, 2003.
2003. Have you done an updated one since the 2012 presidential
election? No, I haven't. 2012 was a a status quo election, very little changed. And so there wasn't any real need to do anything. I've looked at the data and concluded that nothing needs to be readdressed.
So when you look at some of the issues that we talk about in the states, and we're up here in Northern California in Silicon Valley at Stanford, are we in a completely blue area?
Yes, we are. Yes, this area, what you look at when you see a map of California is some very deep blue pockets, especially along the coasts and in the major metropolitan areas, and then redder areas everywhere else. Wherever you have a lot of redwood trees and a lot of cows and a lot of farms, desert, you tend to see more red.
Right, but in Silicon Valley itself, are there red pockets? Are there people who aren't that polarized, or are they polarized?
There are political differences everywhere. Even in Manhattan, there are political differences, and you'll find them here too. But what makes it difficult for even people you would normally think of as Republicans, wealthy people who have a lot of stock options, etc.? The California Republican Party looks more like a Texas Republican Party. I've joked to some of my Republican friends that your platform is to log the redwoods, kill the salmon, and bash gays. And that just doesn't appeal even to wealthy people in this area. That they vote regularly for Democrats who are going to raise their taxes because they basically have no choice. So you can't really tell what people are thinking from how they're voting because they can only vote between two alternatives. And so just the fact that they're continually voting for Democrats doesn't mean that given a different kind of Republican, a Pete Wilson kind of Republican, a George Dumagian kind of Republican, even a Ronald Reagan kind of Republican, the voting patterns might be very different than what we're getting now.
And that's because the Republican Party itself is controlled by...
The brand, if you talk to the people here, the former Republican state chairman, the current state chairman, they realize that a lot of the base, the Republican base in California, has its roots in the more deserty rural areas, and the social issues are very strong with them, and they'd rather lose with a social conservative than win with a moderate. And that's why Schwarzenegger was such an anomaly that he probably couldn't have made it through a Republican primary in California, but the recall gave him the opportunity to run when the entire electorate was voting.
You have a chart in this book, and I want to ask you if this is still up to date when it comes to Congress. This is Congress in the 1960s. You can see the blue and the red, and you can see overlap here. And then you say that Congress has gotten more and more polarized.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That has not changed in the slightest.
How has this happened?
This has happened. There are a couple of things going on here. One is simply change, social and demographic change in the country, that African Americans move north from the South, making Northern Democrats a more racially liberal party. The Sun Belt, the tremendous growth of the Sun Belt, led to the South becoming a more conservative and conservative economically region. We've seen the various 60s social movements align with one party or the other, the environmentalists, the women's movement, et cetera, with the Democrats, the religious right with the Republicans. And these have driven basically the two parties apart. The argument I make continually is what's happened in the U.S. is sorting, not polarization. That a generation ago, or most people, I'm getting to the point where most people are younger than I am now, but I remember when there were lots of conservative Democrats and lots of liberal Republicans. In the Northeast, you had highly liberal senators like Jacob Javits, a Republican. In the South, you had conservative Democrats. Whereas now, basically they've disappeared in both parties at the highest levels. You have very few conservatives in the Democratic Party, very few liberals in the Republican Party, and so the parties have been driven apart. But the actual number of liberals, conservatives, Democrats, and Republicans hasn't changed all that much, if anything, since the 1970s. So people are much better sorted now. And the result is the bases of the two parties, the activists, are highly polarized because they're sorted out, and they're pretty much the same. Massachusetts Democrats and Mississippi Democrats aren't that different in the base, and same thing for Republicans, contrary to a generation ago. And so politics has become more polarized, but it's not because the middle has disappeared. It's not because there are fewer moderates. It's just the middle has a home in neither party now. The middle is basically adrift.
Professor Fiorina, what about hot-button issues? Gay marriage, gun control, abortion. Aren't we divided on those issues? I mean, isn't there a clear yes and no?
we are divided again, if you think of we as the political elites. This is something that's not really appreciated. Right now, since Obama's election and his inaugural address, what are some of the issues he's focused on? He said, we're going to deal with gun control, we're going to deal with immigration, we're going to deal with global warming. The Pew Foundation, the Pew Research Center, a very reputable organization, put out a poll in January. And the poll asked people, what do you think the priorities, the major priorities of the President and the Congress should be in the coming year? And there were 21 options. Immigration was 17 out of 21. Gun control was 18 out of 21. This is a month after Sandy Hill. And global warming was 21 out of 21. And this is a point I've made in the books, that the priorities of the political class are often very different from the priorities of the American public. The American public is concerned with bread and butter issues, especially at a time like this. They're concerned about their jobs, the economy, deficits, health care, their kids' schools, etc. And I'm not saying these other issues aren't important. I'm just saying, from the standpoint of the average voter, these are way down their list of priorities. And yet that's the subject of my second book, actually, Disconnect. It's not the subject, but one of the things we deal with in this one is the priorities of the political class. And the things we fight our politics over are things that are generally not high up on the priority list of the American public.
Why is that?
It's because these things are very important to the political class. We have a Democratic Party. It's been described as limousine liberal, and I think there's a certain element to that. And the Republicans, for their part, have allied with the religious right. And so these issues are of deep concern to them, and yet not so much to the average American. There has been this poll asking for years and years about the most important issues facing the Republic. And the only one I've ever seen where gay rights was not, gay marriage was not at the bottom, was one that included tort reform. And most Americans, of course, have no idea what a tort is. And so tort reform came in dead last in that one. But usually, I mean, especially in an area like this, if you tell people, the polls say that Americans don't really care all that much about gay marriage, people just don't believe you. But just survey after survey shows that.
What do people in Oklahoma and Northern California, where are they going to agree?
I think if you
and
put
when
them,
I say Northern California, I should say
yeah, no, I
this
think if you put
the
them into a room, and again, we're talking here not about people really active in politics who give money, but just go pick a bunch of people off the Oklahoma street, Norman Street. Well, Norman's probably at the university town, so that's not a good idea. But take some city or take some urban area here. Put them down in the room. They start talking, and they find out, gee, we're not all that different. That they can sort of, you know, it's not going to be we solve the deficit entirely through cutting spending or entirely through raising taxes. It's going to be some of both. And let's talk about where we can find common ground. And I think on issue after issue, you'll find that. I get a certain number of calls from reporters who report that they decided to do one of these red-blue comparisons. And so they went into a neighborhood, and they say, well, I couldn't find it. I talked to the reddest person on the block, a Republican, and it turned out they were the best friends of the bluest person on the block. And I think when you talk about ordinary, reasonable Americans, as opposed to the ones who watch the shows on TV and who sort of try to convince each other about how pure they are in their political views, I think you're talking about a country that's still very reasonable and still full of a lot of common sense.
In Culture Wars question mark, you have a chart here, and I want to ask if you're going to use this updated chart after when you update this book after the 2012. Eligible voting age in the U.S. in 2004, 202 million. Voted in 2004, 122 million. Bush voters, 62 million. Kerry voters, 59 million. People who saw Fahrenheit 9/11, which was what?
It was a movie about, God, as I can recall, I didn't actually see it. It was Michael Moore's movie, and it had a huge, you know, splash. But in terms of who actually saw it, yeah. Uh-huh.
17 to 18 million people. Mm-hmm. People who listened to Rush Limbaugh last week, or in 2004, 15 to 16 million people. Daily audience for The O'Reilly Factor, 3.3 million. Daily audience for Fox News, 3.3 million. 0.74 million Kerry vote in Iowa, 0.12 million Democratic turnout for the caucus in Iowa, 0.6 million Howard Dean's email list, and 0.56 million number of admitted ferret owners.
Yes.
Why do you put that chart in here?
Just to show how unrepresentative, well, how small the political class is. That by the political class, I mean the people who run for office, who donate, who work, who lead the interest groups, the pro-choice, pro-right, pro-life groups, etc. And they are the public face of politics in America. They are the ones who are on TV. They are the ones voters see. But I wanted to make the point of how small that sliver of America is relative to the overall population. Let me give you some statistics from the last election, the Republican primary fight, which was, you know, a leader every week. The night that Rick Santorum became a national contender by winning three contests, he won in Minnesota, Colorado, and Missouri, the turnout of registered voters in those states was 1 in 200 in 1 in 100 in Colorado, 1 in 200 in Minnesota, and 1 in 7 in 100 in Missouri. I mean, I may have the figures slightly off, but the proportion of people actually turning out and voting in these primaries was so small, and yet they are driving the nomination process. And that's going on all over the country, that the people who are actually participating, nominating candidates, are small and highly unrepresentative segments of the population. One of the points I made in a recent article was of the 60 million or so votes that Mitt Romney got, 57 million had not watched Fox News the night before. And the same thing for Obama and MSNBC, only more so. That these shows, which are everybody in Washington, they say, did you see this last night? Did you see that? And they worry about things. They are just over the heads of most Americans. People aren't watching them.
So, Professor Fiorina, is there a solution? Should there be a solution? Because, like you say in your book, Disconnect, the politicians have figured out that these are the issues that motivate segments of voters.
Yeah. Every time I write something, editors want me to have something positive to say, and I don't. I mean, I've been a professor for 40 years. I've never been more concerned about the future that lies ahead, not because of the American public, but because of the American leadership class. At the same time, I have great faith in the public. I have great faith that somehow we'll muddle through. I just can't see what it is. All of the proposals that are put forward, redistricting, primary reform, et cetera, they won't hurt, but they're just unlikely to do much real good. I think at some point, maybe we're going to see another, David Brooks in a column years ago said, somewhere out there, there's a younger, saner Ross Perot. And I think something like that, that a third party movement of somebody from the common sense center that shakes things up enough is probably our only real hope.
What do you teach here at Stanford?
I teach political science. I teach the American Politics Introductory course. I've taught that for about 35 years now, and an assortment of seminars.
What do you hear? Do you have? Are your students different today than they were 30 years ago? They ask the same questions?
Well, yes. Now, given I'm only dealing with a small sample of people in a highly, highly selective university, but first of all, the students today are not politically. My sense is young people are not as politically involved as we were. We were coming out of Vietnam. There was a real reason to be politically concerned in the 60s. I think there is a sense in which they're disillusioned from politics. There's an understanding. I mean, I one of the things I think Republicans are missing is that, obviously they have problems among the young, and it's because of the social issues. And yet, I when I find the young students, I find a sense of openness to new economic policies, that they know the old policies aren't working, or at least they're not sustainable, put it that way. They realize they're worried about Social Security. They're not worried, it's too far away, but they sort of suspect Social Security won't be there for them. They've seen the trend lines. They know Medicare is just unsustainable in its present form. So I think they're open to a kind of a new sort of set of economic appeals, but the very conservative social issues of the Republican Party just make it unacceptable, just like they do to many of the other people in Silicon Valley. And that's going to drive change. I mean, there's only so long a party can lose elections before. We've seen the I think what we're seeing today with the Republicans is very similar to what we saw with the Democrats from 1972 to 1992, that you have a party that's gotten off course relative to the American public, loses one election after another, and finally there's going to come a Bill Clinton, sort of haul them back in the center and win again. May take a while. It took the Democrats 20 years. The Republicans are only partway through this cycle, so it may be a while before we see a really competitive Republican candidate again.
Well, RNC Chair Reince Priebus just announced that they're going to open up an office here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
He's an optimist.
That's all you got for it?
That's all I got.
We've been talking with Morris Fiorina, political science professor here at Stanford University, author of this series, Culture War, The Myth of a Polarized America, as well as this book, Disconnect, The Breakdown of Representation in American Politics.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be nervous, Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination. Men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, all at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fools had to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. Where? Waist deep in big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Coming up next, from the movie The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin does the closing address.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel? Who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder? Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power, let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite! Hannah, can you hear me? Wherever you are, look up, Hannah. The clouds are lifting. The sun is breaking through. We are coming out of the darkness into the light. We are coming into a new world, a kindlier world, where men will rise above their hate, their greed, and brutality. Look up, Hannah. The soul of man has been given wings, and at last he is beginning to fly. He is flying into the rainbow, into the light of hope, into the future. The glorious future that belongs to you, to me, and to all of us. Look up, Hannah. Look up.
That's all, folks.